Hello and welcome to SciGuys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always I'm joined by my co-host, the lexicographic Luke Cutforth.
Is that something to do with words?
This week we're talking about Dial Sexy or Sexy Lax, but first we have to thank our patrons because they voted for this one. Thank you.
Thank you, I think. We'll find out.
If you want to be a patron, head over to our Patreon at patreon.com/SciGuys or at SciGuys.co.uk/Patreon. We've made it very easy and also somehow very confusing for you, but that's not all we've got to do. We've also got a question to ask, and if you are listening on Spotify or you're watching on YouTube, lucky you, you can answer the question very easily by going to the comments on either of those applications or webbed sites. But if you are listening elsewhere, well, here's what you need to do. Write us a letter and then write the letter again, but jumble up all the words, and then do it again and jumble up all the words, and do it again and again and again and again until you've got back to the original letter, and then send that. The middle steps are very important. If you don't jumble up the letters every single time you do it, then we're not going to read it. We'll know. The question is, Luke, do you have dyslexia?
Not that I know of, but after whatever you just said, I might.
Yeah! So, do you know what dyslexia is?
Oh, I wouldn't want to assume that I know the full definition because I'm sure it's more complicated than I think it is, but I think that on the surface, my understanding is to do with a difficulty in reading and writing and possibly speaking sometimes.
You know what, Luke? You actually did get the full definition. As in, you're a fool, and you gave the definition. I'll give you the actual definition. I'm sorry, no. That wasn't true. I just... As soon as you said full definition, I was like, oh, I've got one here. Oh, it's in the bag. So it's a specific learning difficulty, not disability. That's a very important distinction. It basically causes problems with, as you said, reading and writing. And yeah, in some cases, speaking, but we'll get into the specifics of it in just a sec. If we look at the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of dyslexia from 2010, they use this definition. Dyslexia is characterized by specific isolated impairment of reading and spelling, which cannot be explained by delayed development of cognitive abilities or low intelligence. Essentially, the difference between a learning disability and a learning difficulty is that with a learning disability, intelligence is affected. With a learning difficulty, intelligence isn't necessarily affected. Oh. So you can be an absolute genius and still be dyslexic, in the same sense that you could be, you know, you could have ADHD and still have a high IQ. Not that IQ is necessarily the best way of measuring people as a whole, but yeah, you know, that's kind of the distinction there. And do you know where the word comes from, dyslexia?
It's one of two. It's either Greek or Latin. Is it not?
No, it's both.
It's both. Wow, it's not either one or two.
So, I mean, it's kind of, I think it was coined in Germany. So the dys is kind of a mix of German, Old English, English, and Ancient Greek.
Okay.
It comes from a lot of those places, I guess. But essentially, dys just means difficult or bad. And lexia, meaning speech, from the Ancient Greek, which then came itself from, I think the ancient Latin. It's just Latin, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that came from the Latin legere, to read. But in Greek, lexia means speech. So it's like bad speech or bad sort of read.
Bad word.
It is a fucking bad word, Luke. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I'll have to bleep that one out. Some stats for you. How many people do you think are dyslexic?
12.
A bit more than that.
12 million.
I can't do the maths quick enough. No, I don't think that is... look, it's 5 to 10% of people.
Wow!
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's way more than I thought.
Well, there's a reason that it'll be way more than you thought. We'll get into that later on. It's becoming my catchphrase for this episode. But no, there is an actual reason for it being probably higher than you expected. But yeah, I would have thought probably about 5%. But that 10% number is kind of way high. Because, I mean, if you think about when you're in school, 10% of kids in your class having dyslexia or being dyslexic, right? I feel like... doesn't feel right, you know what I mean?
Yeah, what I'm sort of getting at is that normally when you have something like the world isn't set up for someone, like if somebody is trans, for example, someone has ADHD or somebody's gay or something, like normally those people are like a very small portion of the population, like 1%, and that contributes to society not really catering to them. But 5 to 10% is like, that's getting to the point where that's like basically just normal, right? Mm. It's getting to the point where, like, you will know lots of people who are that, no matter how like a sort of sheltered life you have, someone you know will be dyslexic.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you say, you bring up ADHD there. I mean, the numbers for ADHD go up to 10 to 13% in terms of people being diagnosed. Yeah, I mean, the numbers can get that high. For 6 to 11 years, that's 10%. Or 12 to 17 years, it's 13% in the US, right? So those numbers can get quite high. And yeah, with dyslexia, it is higher than you'd think. And you would think, yeah, maybe the world should be a little bit better at this. It's not, though. It's not. In the UK, there is no sort of screening or sort of countrywide screening. Mm. I think it's more down to a school-by-school kind of basis. And we can sort of screen for this before school age, which a lot of people don't seem to know, I think.
Yeah, you'd think you'd have to learn to read before you can learn, like, figure out if someone's dyslexic.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. It's just a misconception. It's about a bit more than just reading and writing. So you can spot those kinds of things earlier. Again, we'll get into that in just a
God,
second.
God, you're such a tease.
I know, mate. I know. You've got to tease these things. So 40 to 60% of dyslexic kids have psychological problems, apparently. So that could be anything from depression to anxiety or, you know, a feeling of rejection. Perhaps rejection-sensitive dysphoria. Who knows? It doesn't say that here. I'm spitballing here. So if we go through the comorbidities, do you have any ideas what some of those might be?
ADHD?
Mm-hmm.
Autism?
Oh, no. I don't see autism on my list of things, but ADHD is definitely on there.
Well, you've already mentioned depression, anxiety. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll get into why that might be.
I think it's pretty obvious.
Well, what I mean is, like, are you feeling depressed or anxious because you have a difficulty, or do they have a root cause? Is what I mean.
It's because of the difficulty, Luke.
Okay,
yeah,
fair
it's
enough.
Because of how the world treats. Yeah,
I was just giving you another thing to tease me over. also, possibly like dyspraxia as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I've run out of things that might be the case.
Yeah, I mean, you could also see dyscalculia. I cannot say that word.
Dyscalculia.
No, there's
dyscalculia.
An I in there. There's an I in there. Yeah.
Wow.
Dyscalculia. That's why it gets me. It should be dyscalculia. That sounds better, but it's not it. Problems with short-term memory, and as you've mentioned, dyspraxia as well. And yeah, twice as high the depression rate in adolescents with dyslexia.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense. It shouldn't make sense.
Nope.
But it does. Yep. Anxiety disorders, apparently 3 times higher.
Wow.
Yeah. And again, ADHD, that is the most common sort of comorbidity there when it comes to dyslexia. So that's about 20%.
Wow.
Yeah, which is mad, right? Do you know any of the signs and symptoms of dyslexia?
Mixing up your letters, I think. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times I've heard people talk about dyslexia, it's almost like if you looked at a page, like the letters will like move or like are not in the right order as they are, as you know they must be. So misspelling things and mixing up letter placements, things like that. Yeah, I don't know anything else.
Yeah, so that's a lot of it. Confusing orders of letters in words as well, sort of poor spelling, which I don't know if you mentioned explicitly. Yeah, but sort of not even just poor spelling. This is from the NHS as well, by the way. So inconsistent spelling, they mentioned. So, you know, poor spelling would be, I guess, almost spelling something wrong in the same way every time. But if you're spelling things incorrectly in different ways, you know what I mean? That quite clearly shows something different than just not knowing how to spell a word.
Yeah, it's not like every time you're phonetically spelling it, for example.
Yeah, and also difficulty understanding written information, but being fine when you're told it verbally, right? Which, again, all of this seems quite obvious, but I think it's important to mention there's a few different sort of presentations throughout one's life. So it can present differently, you know, before school compared to when you're in primary school, compared to when you're sort of an adolescent, compared to adults, right? Like, there's differences in how it presents over the course of one single person's life, alongside it being different in presentation between sort of individual people, which I find quite interesting. I mean, before we get into those sort of more specific parts of life, do you have any ideas of some of the sort of things that people could confuse dyslexia with? So what is it? The differential diagnosis, I guess it would be.
Well, firstly, I think most obviously dyspraxia.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
From the little I know about dyspraxia. Mm-hmm. Also, you said interestingly in your diagnostic criteria that it was like, and it's also not to do with like intellectual ability or like brain power. I can't remember. Like there's no like presence of like
a learning disability.
Having a learning disability, but it would be possibly mistaken for a learning disability either either early on or like if you don't really know, if you're not very educated on it. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think back to your diagnostic criteria.
Try and think of it in the sense of like, if someone can't read something.
Oh, like eyesight problems.
Yeah, absolutely. So
fascinating.
You could have people thinking that, you know, someone's got problems with their eyesight when actually they're dyslexic and vice versa as well. So it's one of the things that is mentioned, you know what I mean? And so it's again, it's one of those things you don't really think of, I guess, when you're trying to figure out, okay, what is going on here? There are many ways that someone could sort of present with difficulties reading and writing. And one of those is literally not being able to see. Another one is your brain sort of getting a bit funny when it comes to encoding and decoding sort of not verbal, but, you know, the written word.
Yeah, and making that even more complicated, usually you're trying to diagnose this from a child
yeah.
who can't always report these things very reliably.
Absolutely, right? And so it's really difficult. So if we look at children, as you've so brilliantly brought up there, so that would be delayed speech development. You could see delayed speech development in kids with dyslexia, problems with sort of pronouncing words. And so you were saying there, yeah, you know, how you'd think you could only really diagnose it when they start to learn to read and write. But it's actually sort of even building up words, you know, when kids are learning to sort of speak. There could be issues with that as well, right? So pronouncing words sort of the wrong way, like mixing up. Do you know what a phoneme is?
Yeah, so a phoneme is like a unit of a word. Mm-hmm. What, like a m? Is m a phoneme?
Yeah, so it's just the sounds of a language, right? So like a p, a b, a m.
Like the audio equivalent of letters.
Yes. Yeah? Yes.
Because
yeah.
you could have letters pronounced in different ways that are the same letter but the different phoneme.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, if you were to say sort of good and, nope, there's not another, food, right? Those are, the difference between those is one phoneme, right?
Yes.
Otherwise, they're exactly the same. I suppose it depends on your accent. But in mine, they're yeah. exactly the same, save for those. Now, yeah, you could be swapping around different sort of sounds in words, right? So the examples, I think this is the NHS give, are Betty Tear instead of Teddy Bear, or Heckalopter instead of Helicopter, which I love, by the way. Heckalopter, yeah. Brilliant, way better word. But yeah, no, so sort of mixing up longer words or sort of swapping around different sounds in words. Even as well, difficulty being able to sort of remember specific words or the correct word to use. So building your sentences improperly as well, or, you know, not having any interest in learning the alphabet. Because this is the thing as well that you don't really think of, right? If you're not able to do something and you get sort of a negative reaction when you don't do it correctly, you're not going to have much interest in it. And even then, just not something not coming naturally or something being sort of unreasonably difficult is probably going to turn you off, right? So one of those things as well, not really enjoying doing things with the alphabet, not really enjoying, you know, that sort of like reciting the alphabet or whatever, or learning the alphabet. Not that kids necessarily always love that, but you know what I mean? Like just a complete indifference or aversion to it, or just difficulty with it in the first place.
Yeah, like firstly, it's really interesting you saying not like enjoying, I don't have any recollection of enjoying learning the alphabet. Maybe I did at the time, but I don't have a particular memory of, oh, please, I want to learn the alphabet.
Well, yeah, I think if you think more about how kids are really excited, like if you're,
yeah.
do you know your alphabet? And then they're excited to,
right.
Do you
yeah,
know what I mean?
I was that with times tables. I love times tables.
Oh, man. Do you know what? Can I just say about times tables,
yeah.
right? I felt great having learned those as a kid. Useless. At this point in my life now, utterly useless. Probably good at some point, but it feels pretty useless. Although I do just know the numbers like off by heart.
Oh, yeah. What's 7 times 7?
That's 49.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So when you were talking about sort of like less interest or a bit more resistant to learning like the alphabet, like I suppose if you took a bunch of kids and you picked the ones that were least likely.
I wouldn't take a bunch of kids, Luke. That's a crime.
But if you like,
you should really not. Honestly, mate. Like, I'm going to have to call the police if you keep on doing this. It's a real problem.
I need to find out which one's dyslexic, Corey.
Why?
to help them.
Stop kidnapping children, Luke. Gosh.
If you...
Sorry, I'm just picturing the reason that you want to round up the dyslexic ones is so that, you know what I mean? Like, if you're driving past street signs and stuff, they don't know where you're going. You've got a big glaring exit sign on the way out. And you're like, damn. They're just like, damn, no idea what to do here. we're trapped here forever, I think.
Oh, I went the complete opposite way of being like a really passionate child psychologist and just needing to diagnose all the children.
No, I'm picturing you having this labyrinth set up, and for you to get in and out of it, you've just got directions written on the wall. But you
Like a torture chamber?
No, not a torture chamber.
It's a torture chamber if I'm putting a bunch of kids who can't read very well in there.
And no, they just can't
The directions are there. You just can't read them.
Well, the directions are there. And you have them being dyslexic so that they can't read them, so that you can keep them in. I don't really know what you're going to do.
But why did I put the directions on the wall in the
first? So you don't get lost in your labyrinth.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
And you couldn't just use a code that only I know?
Yeah, that is, they're dyslexic children. I mean,
so it's a code.
It quite literally is a code that only you know. I mean, they've not learned to read yet, and they're having difficulty with the alphabet. Do you think, like, writing direct? Of course.
It just feels a bit like taunting.
I'm not doing it, Luke. Okay? I'm not saying I agree with your methods. To be honest, I don't even really understand them. I don't know what the... Like, I would love to say that the ends justify the means, but in this situation, Luke, I don't know what the ends are.
I've got to sort out the fakers. Which one are pretending to be dyslexic?
Oh,
so I put them in a maze. The ones that escape. The ones that have got TikTok.
TikTok didn't cause an uptick in the kids with dyslexia, but you'll find out what did later on. Carry on, Luke.
Yeah, so what I was trying to get to was, I guess, if you have a group of kids and, like, the ones that are less likely or, like, less eager or more resistant when you suggest that that's what you're doing now, mm-hmm. I suppose that might be, like, an early sign. There might be, obviously, there'll be other reasons why they might not like that specific activity,
sure, yeah.
But that would be an early sign that, like, they're struggling, they're finding it more stressful than the other kids.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, honestly, just talking to kids and having a relationship with them probably helps with that, I'd imagine, even if they're not able to sort of express their feelings brilliantly. If you have like an idea of what might be going on, you can kind of be a bit more receptive to those things. And as well, because dyslexia can be quite genetic, what I mean by that is that if your family, if someone in your family is dyslexic, then you have a higher chance of also being dyslexic, right? And there are some things that, you know, if a kid displays X behavior or Y behavior when they're sort of young as a child, then it's less likely that they'll end up being diagnosed with dyslexia, despite their parents being dyslexic. I can't remember quite what those things are, but it's literally just like the way that they're building words. If they're doing that normally at a certain age, then it's unlikely that they're going to present with dyslexia later in life. But back to primary school kids and sort of specifics of dyslexia with them. You've also got slow writing speed, poor handwriting, which is like, it's like a really, really difficult problem in terms of a kind of feedback loop, in that if you've got poor handwriting and you also struggle to read and, you know, you struggle to write, then you have further issues, because when you try to read your own handwriting, it's not clear and it's harder for you to read it because it's like poor handwriting.
Yeah, and you're less likely to be just doing, like, writing things down because you already find it stressful. So you're less likely to be practicing the handwriting as well.
Yeah, but the point is that, like, the poor handwriting makes it even more difficult for you to, like, improve those skills if you cannot read your own writing.
Yeah.
I mean, because so much of learning to write is, like, sort of reading things and then writing those things and then reading your writing and, you know, going from there, right? And so having poor handwriting being something that is, you know, seen in young kids with dyslexia, it's this really, that's what I'm saying, difficult feedback loop wherein, like, okay, cool, so you have difficulty reading and writing. Well, here's, do some practice of writing and that will help. And if you read your writing, that also helps, blah, 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 right? Cool, I've done that. I can't read this because it's harder to read than the other things because my handwriting is so bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, if you think about it, like, not being able to read your own handwriting would be very difficult. Like, it's kind of one of the core points of being able to write something down. You know, well, not now anymore, right? I suppose, you know, you can type things way more easily with phones than you could 10, 15 years ago. But not being able to write something down and necessarily be able to read it is obviously going to be kind of difficult. Copying written sort of language and taking longer to complete written work is another thing that you'll see in young kids, 5 to 12, with dyslexia. Have I mentioned preschool kids?
No.
Did I mention that? That's what I was... So that's... Yeah, no, I think I did. The jumbling up of, like, Heckelopter.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. So, as I said, there's all of that, but then the symptoms are likely to be more obvious. So you can sort of screen for it before school, but the symptoms become more obvious, obviously, later on when you start engaging with reading and writing far more regularly.
The Heckelopter mixing up sort of phoneme stuff is really interesting, because I think initially, as an outsider, I would have thought that dyslexia is almost like sort of a fairly modern condition in terms of like it's as modern as we've been writing, right? Mm. And like we've probably been writing for less time. We've definitely been writing for less time than we've been speaking, mm-hmm. and we have probably evolved more, had more time to evolve around speaking than we have around our need to write, because writing is a more modern invention. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I would call that if it was specifically just for writing, that's a sort of modern thing, in the same way that like if someone 500 years from now has some kind of genetic thing going on, which means they can't touch type as easily, it's a little bit unfair to sort of suggest that they have a sort of disorder because we've only been touch typing for a little while.
Yeah, I think the difference there is it's not just a difficulty with sort of writing, like the touch typing, that's kind of a different thing. Whereas this would be like, you can still have issues with like typing with dyslexia. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, it's not just sort of like, I have difficulty with this specific thing. Your brain is sort of not encoding and decoding the sort of, what is the word, like written language, mm-hmm. The same as other brains.
But that's what I'm sort of getting at, is that but the fact that it also extends to like hecalopter, to mixing up phonemes, suggests that, and also possibly to handwriting as well, suggests there's something going on. Specifically the phonemes part suggests there's something going on that's not just to do with decoding and encoding written language.
Yeah, no, I absolutely get you. I think the easiest way to think about this is to not separate these concepts in your head so much, right? I mean, not you. I mean, anyone that might be listening, right? The idea that reading and writing are two very separate things from language and speaking, right? They all involve sort of similar things, right? They're all built around language. They're just different sort of facets of understanding and utilizing language. And with dyslexia, it causes kind of, you know, quite specifically, or it causes specifically issues with reading and writing due to that encoding and decoding of sort of language in the brain. And so there can be other sort of issues with it. Yeah, like we were talking about the sort of phonemes there. But primarily what you're going to see once people start, you know, learning to read and write, are those issues with specifically reading and writing. But to get back to those symptoms, we've gone through preschool kids, we've gone through primary school kids, we're going through primary school kids, and we'll continue to do that. So yeah, like mixing up similar looking letters, so like B's and D's or P's and Q's and whatnot, you'll see them sort of reading slowly for obvious reasons, or sort of making more mistakes than you'd expect from other kids. And as well, days of the week, the alphabet sort of sequences like that, apparently there are difficulties with too, right? And then, like we've mentioned, per handwriting, all of those sorts of things. But phonological awareness is also something that comes up. Do you know what that is, by any chance?
Phonological awareness. Is that to do with phonemes? Like being aware of which phoneme is being used?
Yeah, so, and I think this is from the NHS, I believe. If not, you can check the places down in the description and you'll find out where all this information is from. I'll read this verbatim. Phonological awareness is the ability to recognize that words are made up of smaller units of sound, phonemes, there you go, and that changing and manipulating phonemes can create new words and meanings. So the questions that are sort of given as examples that a kid with poor phonological awareness is going to maybe struggle with would be something like, what sounds do you think make up the word hot? Are those different from the sounds that make up the word hat? Right? So
they wouldn't be able to pick out the O and the A is the thing that changed.
Yeah, not necessarily, right? Yeah. If you, you know, or even rhyming words, right? So what rhymes with pot or spot or, you know, cot, all of those sorts of things. So picking out the sort of specific sounds of words and separating those from the sort of word as a whole. And then, do you know what word attack is? I didn't know this either. It's been brought up as though it's something like just very common, and I guess maybe it is, but also it would have been from a time in my life where I'm not gonna remember what that is. So word attack would be breaking down a word into smaller parts and sort of getting some meaning from that, right? Breaking a longer word into smaller, more familiar words.
Okay.
And then figuring out what it means from that. And that sounds really difficult, right? But it's much easier than you'd think. So, I mean, motorcycle, for example.
Right.
If you've never encountered the word motorcycle before, you'd probably be able to figure out what a motorcycle is if you already knew what a bike was and what a motor was.
Right? Wow, the Germans would have a great time with this game. Because their whole language is just 20 words smashed together.
That's true. That is true. Yeah. I mean, what is it? Hand shoes, I think, gloves? Yeah. Hand shoes or something like that. Yeah. It's brilliant, right? But I mean, you know, that's kind of a thing there that I think is really interesting, that you seem to think it was difficult. A difficult concept, right? Word attack.
I immediately went to, like, I guess, for example, like, walked, and you could go, well, you know what walk means, and you know what, like, when they have like an ed at the end, you know that's past. So this new word, which you haven't seen, walked, that could mean you someone walking, but in the past. I suppose that's word attack. Feels a little advanced.
To be fair, word attack is a lot broader than just that, right? It's also that sort of spelling a word out as well to figure out, you know. So it's essentially, I think, in its broadest sense, would be trying to look at the written word and then sort of translate that into, I guess, the spoken word, which, again, feels like it comes very, very easily, right? Like, you know, if you don't really have anything that sort of, any sort of conditions that impair that, right? It's almost in some ways sort of automatic, right? You look at a word and you kind of just get a vibe for how it might be pronounced. Although sometimes, right, I realize there are words that I'm reading, and because I've never needed to say them out loud, I just kind of don't have a pronunciation for that word in my head. I just kind of read it and I'm like, yep, that word. And I know what it means, and I know what it looks like, and I know the word. I just don't think of how to pronounce it. And that sometimes it happens on the podcast where I come to read the word, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I didn't think about how to pronounce that because it just wasn't relevant in the way that I was engaging with it. But yeah, word attack would be looking at a written word and then sort of connecting it to, you know, verbal, that sort of verbal language, like spoken word. And it's all of those different things, like breaking down words into constituent parts to figure out what they mean, I guess sort of phonetically spelling out, sort of sounding out words you're not necessarily familiar with, and pronouncing them to figure out how to pronounce them or understand them. But yeah, I mean, broadly, word attack is just looking at a word that's written down and figuring out what that is. You know?
Okay, and is that something we all did, or is that like an exercise that you do with somebody with dyslexia because it's less automatic?
No, I mean, if you think about it, you had to do that as a kid, right? Yeah. Do you remember learning how to phonetically spell things out?
If you don't know a word, you're sort of confronted by a word, and you have to learn to attack that word, break it down to into its parts, try and figure out what it might mean, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on to teens and adults, right? Basically everyone over the age sort of 12-ish. Now, all of the things that we've kind of already mentioned will still be sort of present to some degree. But there's also potentially issues with sort of being organized with written work that lacks expression, the NHS says. So the example they've given is being, like, you know, having a lot of knowledge about a certain subject, but having difficulties expressing that knowledge in writing, right? So, like, you know, knowing a lot, but not being able to put that down onto a page. Then also difficulty planning and writing essays, letters, reports, all of that sort of stuff, which, again, makes sense, right? Like, and I don't think we really consider how different speaking is from writing. It's very different. And if you've ever tried to caption anything, you'll understand why. People don't speak really in sentences. I mean, we do, but also we don't. There are run-on sentences. There are half thoughts that get cut off. People interrupt each other constantly, right? You'll use sort of sounds and gestures and a lot of different little bits and things that when you write it down and look at it on a page, it doesn't look right. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't come off right. The flow isn't there. And, you know, you can always tell, I find, when something is a sort of cleaned up transcript or something is a literal just transcript of what a normal person said, not trying to give sort of a rehearsed presentation or whatever.
Yeah, the extreme you have. One thing the news loved to do before Donald Trump was elected was they loved to just directly transcribe everything he said in his speeches, because Donald Trump is an extreme example of what Corey's saying, where he will just speak in like one gigantic sentence and it just goes off on tangents and it never really comes back to its central point. And that's maybe a separate issue, as in like it's a separate thing that he's doing. But he's an extreme example of how, like, you'd never write the way that even Donald Trump would never write the way Donald Trump speaks at a speech.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, you're less likely when Donald Trump speaks, it can sound a bit more coherent than it does when it's written down.
Yes.
If you read it, you're like, this man is not saying anything. And when you hear it, you're like, oh yeah, no, you kind of get it. It's like you can almost feel where he's jumping to with each thing. But as a written word, it just doesn't scan.
And in the opposite extreme, most politicians will have like rehearsed things they're going to say, and you'll like ask a question and they'll basically just they'll meander the point back to something they've already rehearsed, and then they'll just say something that sounds like it was written down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, it's fine to sort of read a report or read quotes or whatever, but for me, yeah, it's just you can feel the difference when someone is sort of just reading something that is written down, especially because when someone reads something that's written down, it's almost as though it's been written to be read, right? I find there's a difference between writing something to be said and writing something to be read. I mean, if you think about YouTube videos even, right? If someone is making a YouTube video, if it's a video essay, let's say, you can't necessarily take that video essay and sort of just take the transcription and have it be sort of on par with the video itself, right? In part, obviously, because video essays that, you know, use the medium well, incorporate the medium into their very essence, such that removing the video from the video essay makes it no longer necessarily as coherent or, you know, not the same experience, right? But even just based on what someone is saying, I think if you were to just read them written down, a lot of them wouldn't really scan the same way that they do or be as engaging, right? You'd need to change some things about how sort of speech that is spoken, is written to make it work as just a written piece. Do you know what I think?
Yeah, whereas when I was doing YouTube videos, I would just say them and then I'd write down what I said and then I'd just re-say it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I would never like write an essay or like write a script. I just like say a bunch of nonsense out loud, write down my nonsense, and then re-say my nonsense out loud.
Yeah, right. See, when I'm writing like a sort of video essay or like a longer video or whatever, right, that what I do is when I'm writing it, I'm saying it, right? I'm not quite as in I'm saying it and then I'm writing it, but like I don't just write something and then think, yeah, that seems good. Like I have to say it to see how it goes, right? And a lot of the things that you put in there, the jokes or whatever you could put in, then become about timing and cadence and things that just can't be done through text, right? And so obviously, based on what we've just said, there are going to be differences between those two things. And so you can understand how it's maybe a bit more difficult than just saying something to yourself and trying to write down what you said, especially if there's then a difficulty with translating sort of language in your head, encoding that into the written word.
Mm.
On top of all the things we've mentioned, I mean, really, honestly, all of these things just involve sort of reading and writing, right? So exams, they bring up having difficulty with those, taking notes, spelling, difficulty remembering phone numbers or PINs, and difficulty meeting deadlines. But then again, you can see how, oh, that looks like ADHD, but it might not be ADHD. It might be, but it might also be just difficulties with reading and writing then causing all these knock-on sort of effects. But yeah, I mean, fundamentally, it is a difficulty sort of encoding the written word into sort of other language, right? So verbal or vice versa, right? Essentially, it's difficulty with reading and writing. Ding-ling-ling. Are you there, God? It's me, the Ad Bell.
Ugh, what do you want?
I want the lovely listeners and viewers of SciGuys to know that they can support the show without spending any of their own money.
Right, and what do you want me to do about it?
Well, I want you to tell them all that they can do that by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts for SciGuys.
Hello, SciGuys listeners, it's me, God. You can support the show by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving a 5-star, very nice review.
And don't forget, if you don't have access to Apple Podcasts, it helps just as much to go ahead and leave a lovely YouTube comment. Amen.
Are we done? I've got a plague to organize.
Okay, let's get back to the show. So let's talk about the causes of dyslexia. Do you have any idea what the causes might be?
Genetics?
Maybe. We don't really know.
Womb stress?
I don't think so. I've just said we don't really know. I don't know why you're continuing to
guess.
Well,
I thought you were saying you don't know about genetics.
No.
We don't know at all.
No, we don't. Well, we know some. We don't know. We don't have a definitive answer, right? It could be to do with sort of when you're really young, learning things, brain growth, something, environment.
Great sentence.
And genetics.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also be not That?
Yeah, anything else at all?
Well, not anything else. It's probably not penguins.
I would like us to re-examine that conclusion.
You can do that on your own time. Thank you very much.
And I will.
God damn it. Are you going to put penguins in your little child labyrinth now? It's a callback to the start.
My penguin and dyslexic child labyrinth. To be fair, neither of those can read my exit signs.
Oh, wait, I was
going
to say, you're going to have to put in a secret code that your penguins can't.
They can't read exit signs either.
You don't know that. Look, you have absolutely no way of knowing whether or not penguins can read.
I'm a penguin expert. I don't know why you haven't realized this yet.
If you're a penguin expert, I feel like you would know whether they cause dyslexia or not.
Well, that's why I'm looking into it, because I'm a penguin expert.
Right, okay.
Penguinologist.
I'm going to move on.
Yeah, please.
Look, I swear to God, actually, and can I just say this? You forgot that penguins were birds not 2 hours ago.
Yeah, it's because I only care about penguins, not birds. I'm a penguinologist, Corey. For God's sake, listen to me.
So... goodness me. Have you ever thought about why you've got reading and writing difficulties happening at the same time?
Well,
why it's not just one or the other?
I would guess that it's because they're sort of one and the same loop, really. Because as you're writing, you're kind of reading. You're kind of like writing something that you could read. Mm-hmm. Like they're the same function, almost like run in reverse.
Yeah, yeah. They're functions that are sort of, I guess, interdependent, right?
Yeah.
One can't necessarily write without being able to read. Well, one can't write something that one can understand without necessarily being able to sort of read. And a necessity almost of, not a necessity of reading, but if one can read, then it also follows that writing would be something that's easier to acquire, right?
Yeah.
If you know what all the things look like, then it's probably going to be easier for you to then replicate that. It's not the exact same thing, obviously, but when it comes to writing, right, if you're able to write something down, you should be able to know what that thing you wrote down, just what it says, right? So you can understand that they're linked in that way. But yeah, with dyslexia, there's issues with converting that sort of phonological information into the written word, right? So that's the issue there, sort of phonological, the sort of sounds into sort of written. So if you're reading and writing, you can see how you've got to, like, in both of those cases, translate what you're reading or what you're writing to or from sounds.
That's interesting. I'd never noticed the fact that when you're writing, you sort of have a thought and you first convert that thought into words almost in your head, like thought out words, but like they're like audible words in your head sort of thing. And then you convert those audible words into letters. It doesn't feel like you can convert a thought directly into letters. You have to convert it into like internal speech first.
Yeah.
Weird.
Well, you also would need to then convert it into words, if that makes sense. Like internal speech, sure, but words, because I feel like words are slightly, we don't have a definition for word, by the way, like a strict like definition for word that encompasses all words and excludes all non-words, because it's the words are made up. But I feel like you need to convert a thought into speech, but speech and words aren't necessarily the same things. Does that make sense to you? Does that make sense? Okay, let me put it this way. Have you ever read tweets from people who are Scottish? And
yeah.
What is that? And they're just like, some people will write almost phonetically.
Yeah. Right? And it makes it like 10 times funnier as well.
Well, I still understand what they're saying, right?
Yeah, even me if, too, but it's so good.
Even if, like, you know what I mean? Like, could have.
Yeah.
People will write could of. C-O-U-L-D space O-F, as opposed to could apostrophe V-E, a contraction of could have, right? Ima is another thing, right? So like, you don't, Ima being a word now, right, is something that doesn't work from sort of the written into speech, right? That is sort of the written language, I guess, emulating how you interpret these words being smooshed together sort of phonetically, right? Or phonologically, right? Because if you're saying Ima, right, that's I'm gonna. Right. So if you're like saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And that's just you. That's just how people speak. Right. You have words that change based on speech, and then necessarily they have to change based on the way they're like, they have to change how they're written after that. And so I feel like words, as in words in speech and written words, are almost kind of different things in a few ways. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you could probably have things that you could write down or you could tweet that you would never say out loud.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, sort of the other way around in terms of like, you don't even, like when you're sort of speaking, you don't necessarily think of speech in terms of words in the sense that you'll smoosh words together and just create sounds that, that sort of convey the same meaning as a word, contractions and whatnot, right? I mean, in the sense, like, Ima, I've mentioned already, right? But, like, there's so many different examples that are not coming to my mind right now of when we talk, how we just sort of mix nicknames, right? And a nickname was an eek name, and then it became a nickname, I think, based on people just saying it that way, right? And then people misunderstanding what was said and then writing it down in that particular way, right? Like, I feel like the spoken word and the written word are very different things, even on the level of, like, words. Yeah?
Do you mean that they kind of, like, evolve separately? Like, our language changes over time differently in the spoken word than it does in the written word?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in that sense, absolutely, yeah. I just think that the way that we think of these things are kind of different. There are things that we'll do with sounds in speech that we wouldn't do in the written word, and vice versa, kind of like you mentioned earlier. Do you know what I mean? Just because... there are puns that work when they're written down, and there are puns that work when they're spoken out loud, and there are puns that work both, and there are ones that, you know, I mean, are exclusive to one or the other. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like there are just certain sort of differences in how we experience words based on whether they're spoken or written. And in a lot of cases, it can feel, I guess, as though they're one and the same thing. But also, I mean, I feel like, not empirically, but like they kind of, we've got enough evidence from just anecdotal evidence, let's say, of that not really being the case, right? Based on just how we interact with words differently based on whether they're written down or whether we're speaking them, right?
I think what you're saying is like, it's actually interesting. I think this is actually, it's a thing in Buddhism actually, Corey. So well done for being the Buddha reincarnate. But I think there's like this idea of like the word apple and the... when you write down the word apple and an apple are not the same thing. But when we think of them in our mind, for some reason, like we conflate them all. And even like the sound of an explosion is not an explosion and is not even the sound of an explosion. But we sort of conflate them all into one sort of weird box in our head.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost necessary for us understanding things, right? To understand that, for example, you know, the word apple is not a one-to-one with... It only represents the concept of what an apple is.
Yeah.
Right? Because otherwise, if you were to change the word, like the written word apple or the spoken word apple to a slightly different word and still refer to the same thing, right? It doesn't mean that the concept itself has changed in any way. It's just the thing you use to identify this concept has changed somewhat. It's actually really weird, to be honest with you. Like, the fact that we've got so many words to point to so many different concepts, and those words are not the concepts themselves, but we put meaning in the words as though they were the concepts. And also, there are so many discrete concepts that we have just an understanding of, that there are so many, words, right? Discrete, even, right? Discrete. If I say discrete, you know what I mean. Well, you don't, because there's two kinds of discrete. So you know broadly what I mean. That's just a concept. A concept of discretion exists. And we have multiple words for describing it, right? That's not something that exists, right? It's not like an apple where it's like it's useful to have the concept. Like,
yeah.
To point to the concept of apple or tiger or even something like, you know, death. All very useful things to be able to point towards. Discretion is so specific. It's stupidly specific. It's obscenely specific. And we've got multiple words for it. Mad. Anyway. dyslexia, reading and writing. When you've got difficulties with both of those, that's because those two processes are kind of sort of linked. We found a paper. It might not be a paper. I think it was a paper. I found something that said that reading is kind of a subskill required throughout the writing process, right? So it's kind of what we were saying earlier, in that if you want to be able to write, you kind of need to be able to read also.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of when you were describing how, like, AI image generators work, where, like, if you take, we'll stick with Apple, for example, for now. You take the word Apple, and then what the AI is doing, the way it's been trained, is it's generating something that could be plausibly described as Apple, right? That's how it worked when you described it. It was basically generating random noise, and it was generating the random noise in a direction in which how a human moderator or how a different AI used, which looks at a picture and describes it, how likely it was to describe that picture as Apple. And in the same way, when we write, say, for example, we're writing the letter A in order to write the word Apple, we don't write the letter A. We make a shape that would be described as a letter A.
It can be understood as a letter A by...
Right.
And hopefully someone else.
Yes. Yeah. And so necessarily, and so like, the, and the neater you write, or like the more precisely you write, or the more sort of like a font, for example, creates something that could be described as the letter A, but also can could be described as like spooky, or be described as friendly, or described as formal. So when we're writing, we're naturally at the same time reading our own writing to check that it plausibly could be described as the letter we intended to write at that time. So it's like, that's why I say it's like one system in reverse, because when you look at a letter, you are going, oh, that's an A, that's most likely described as an A. And then when you write, you're going, I want to make something that would be described as an A.
But this is the thing, when you're reading, are you saying this is an A or something that could be described as an A, or are you saying that represents one of these sounds?
Yes, and you're also not reading the individual letters. You're reading the word as an object.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
It's very, it's a lot. And so, yeah, I mean, this is the thing, that reading and writing are obviously quite linked. And so, yeah, I mean, that's why you'll see reading and writing difficulties, because sort of linked to each other in this way, because you're sort of processing phonological information and then encoding phonological information. And both of those things are obviously, like you're kind of saying, like sort of almost reverse pathways of each other there. And so if we talk about diagnosis, I hinted earlier at the numbers going up, the percentage of people diagnosed with dyslexia going up. And that was due to the DSM-5 in 2013. Do you have any idea what might have gone on there?
Did they broaden the definition?
Yeah, so they changed the diagnostic criteria, and it just meant that I think the numbers almost doubled. But on top of the numbers going up, the sort of presentation was kind of more different, let's say. It was different across within that group, right? So you had a much broader range of presentations amongst people with dyslexia after they'd updated the sort of diagnostic criteria. And we'll run through what the diagnostic criteria are now really quickly. Now, the key thing here is that you can't really be diagnosed, well, you're not necessarily diagnosed with dyslexia. You're more diagnosed with a specific learning disorder, right? And so what that means is it could be dyscalculia, dysgraphia, or, you know, dyslexia, any of those sorts of things. They're all under the sort of umbrella term of specific learning disorders. And that sort of itself is under the umbrella term of, I guess, sort of neurodivergence or neurocognitive disabilities or whatever, right? There's that kind of area of ideas, right? neurodivergence, right? That falls under that. And so, yeah, dyslexia is a specific learning disorder as opposed to being dyslexia, its own distinct thing.
It's like a genre.
Kind of, yeah.
Like
subclass. Yeah, exactly. And so to be diagnosed with a specific learning disorder, you would need to have the four following criteria, or meet the four following criteria. So, difficulties in at least one of the following areas for at least 6 months despite targeted help. Difficulty reading, difficulty understanding the meaning of what is read, difficulty with spelling, difficulty with written expression. So that would be problems with grammar or punctuation. Difficulty understanding number concepts, number facts, or calculation. Difficulty with mathematical reasoning. So that would be solving mathematical problems and whatnot, or applying concepts from mathematics. Now, the second criteria, that was the first criteria, you need to have at least one of those for 6 months, despite targeted help. That's a key point as well, right? So if you get sort of help there and it doesn't improve, then that might be like, you know, that would be one of the criteria. Now, I think, I guess the reason for that would be to kind of, in one sense, rule out any issues with lack of education or, you know, anything like that, wherein you're not getting enough attention, you're not getting enough education on that, and so you're falling behind in that way. Two. The second criteria, you'd need to have academic skills that are substantially below what is expected for your age and cause problems in school, work, or everyday activities, right? So you can't just have difficulties with reading and be still within the sort of, I guess, average or expected range for your age group. The third criteria is that the difficulties start during sort of school age, even if you don't have like serious problems until adulthood. I think this is all from the American Psychological Association, basically the ones that write the DSM-5, taking it straight from them. So even if, you know, you're fine in school, and the problems kind of become unmanageable as an adult, you still would have to have had those problems present at school age to get that diagnosis. And then the fourth one is that the learning difficulties are not due to another condition, like an intellectual disability, vision or hearing problems, a neurological condition, like a sort of stroke, and all of those sorts of things, including economic disadvantage, lack of instruction, or difficulty speaking or understanding the language. So as, I guess, as a second language or difficulty speaking or understanding language itself as a language, right? So basically you can't get diagnosed with dyslexia if, you know, you've moved to the UK from another country and you're learning it as a second language. And also you are, the reason that you're struggling is because you're in an underfunded school and you're not being taught by a teacher that's paying a lot of attention, all of those sorts of things, right? If that was the case, that was why you had had trouble sort of reading and writing, that's not dyslexia, obviously, right? But it has to be part of the diagnostic criteria. And in the UK, I think these sort of tests are done by the British Dyslexia Association. So that's where you'd get that. But obviously, you could check through at the NHS for all of that. And when it comes to treatment, do you have any ideas what there might be in the way of treatment?
I would guess pretty much nothing other than sort of extra help.
Yeah, basically, yeah, just targeted sort of help with those sorts of things. And the key point here is as well that early sort of finding it early improves outcomes dramatically, right? So early screening and then early help will really, really improve someone's, I guess, outcomes, you know, later on in life. So we would want to really focus on finding this, as you're saying, you know, rounding up all your children that you find and screening them for dyslexia. Whether or not you put them in your labyrinth, Luke, that's another question. But yeah, no, it would really help to get that help early, right? And I guess it's probably something to do with, you know, building those basic skills at that age, earlier on, as opposed to trying to build those sort of reading and writing skills later in life.
Do you know if there are ways that to teach somebody with dyslexia that are different to the way you teach someone without dyslexia?
Yeah, I mean, there are some things that kind of come out where it's like, oh, these fonts are potentially easier, or if you use these certain sort of little skills to focus down on specific words and whatnot. There are a few different methods, but again, it's not like there's one sort of, this works for absolutely everyone. But yeah, no, it's one of those things that, you know, it's sort of not necessarily, say, underdiagnosed. I don't know how how accurate the diagnoses are, but, you know, because of a change in how it was sort of classified, or how the sort of diagnosis, or the changing the diagnostic criteria, the diagnoses just went up like pretty quickly, and still we're not really necessarily doing enough. I think it's the most common sort of neurodevelopmental disorder or condition. Sort of, if you talk about neurodivergence, it's probably, I think, the most common one of those, or one of the most studied as well. And yet, yeah, we just don't know quite enough on this. I mean, I feel it's the same story whenever we talk about sort of ADHD or dyspraxia or any of these sorts of things, right? Wherein we're just like, oh man, yeah, we don't really know, to be honest with you. We don't know enough. We want to know more.
It feels very frustrating, especially when you have like 10% potentially. And it's like, you're sitting in an exam hall, right? Imagine you've not done any diagnoses. And you're in an exam hall and you're like, 10% of the kids in this room are going to get a worse grade than they deserve. And it's not due to any of their ability to do the subject. It's to do with their ability to read and write the question and answer. That's when it's 10%, when it's like 1 in 10 of the kids, if there's 30, there's 3 of them in here.
Yeah.
If there's 100, there's 10 of them in here. It just makes it feel like that system of how you sort of judge people's worth, basically, is already skewed against 10% of your students.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you think about how fundamental reading and writing skills are, you know, it becomes really evident as a serious problem. And like, I think we just need to do, you know, more screening, like sort of countrywide screening at sort of standardized ages and whatnot, just to really try and get help as soon as possible. And, you know, it doesn't, a screening as well, I should point out, because people seem to misunderstand this. Screening is not a diagnosis, right? It's screening. You are potentially finding people that are at higher risk or who are more likely to, you know, be diagnosed with this, right? And if you start you know, helping people as early as possible. And realistically, you don't even need to screen for this. You could just see kids that are struggling and have the sort of resources to give them the accommodations and help that they need, whether or not they're diagnosed, right? Because if you think about it, like, it shouldn't really matter broadly whether someone is dyslexic, right? When it comes to their education, in the sense that, like, okay, this is your level of reading. This is sort of, you have these difficulties. You shouldn't need a diagnosis of dyslexia to get those accommodations. You shouldn't need a diagnosis of dyslexia for sort of targeted help where you need it. Because even if you're subclinical, right, by a smidge, by a margin, right, it's going to help you anyway. It's going to help people. It's going to help everyone if we have a more focused sort of education sort of focusing in more on helping those that need the extra help. And yes, it would mean more funding, it would mean more teachers, blah, blah, blah. But, like, that's good and important.
Yeah.
So we should maybe think about it.
Yeah, it's weird that you'd be like, these kids are struggling for this reason, so we're going to help them. These kids are not struggling for that reason, so we're going to not help them.
Yeah.
What?
Okay.
What do you mean?
I don't think that's pretty much it. There's just one thing left. It's the quickfire quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Dyslexia edition.
The rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question. That's one question between you and the audience. The first person to answer the question after finished asking it wins. What do they win, Luke?
A little bit of extra time at their exams.
Fantastic. And the question for you is... name another specific learning difficulty that is not dyslexia.
Dyspraxia.
No.
Dyscalculia.
Close enough. Ding, ding, ding. That is correct.
Dyscalculia.
And that is all from us. But before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with an extra special thank you to executive producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit. And thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/thighguys, or you can find a goddad Sci-Guys Pod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at Sci-Guys on TikTok too.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com. SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Yeb.
Bye.